And welcome to this very, very special edition of Technology Bites. It's very, very special edition of Technology Bites.
I feel so special.
Why is it special?
I think we're missing something. I think there's
that makes
a
it special.
Piece.
Not yes, less than special.
Very special.
It's gonna be like special ed. You know, this is Technology Bites, your favorite computer call-in help show. Do we have Peter?
Yes.
Yeah.
You do.
It's Peter.
You sound clear. Oh,
right. You do. You sound clear as a bell, Peter.
Yeah, I made sure and reset the modem before the show.
Did you flush your DNS?
No.
We'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, that's right.
I save mine.
You save your DNS in little jars?
Yeah, I do.
And wear tissue boxes.
Gross.
Maybe we can get a non-echoey version of the vitals.
Could be. So perfect. Who are we, Peter?
Well, I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's Groove House.
That's who we be.
Yeah, see, when I'm not directly in the studio, then we don't miss Groove House on the intro when Jay's not here. But first off, of course, there's the vital statistics. You are listening to Technology Bites. Whether you're listening to it live, if you're in Houston tonight, or if you're in other places, well, then we're just pale shadows. The website, which works all the time, regardless of when you listen to the show, is at geekradio.com. And on there, you can, if you want, go on the IRC channel, where during the live show on Wednesday night, there's probably more people than the rest of the time. But that's at irc.cuckoo.com, and the channel is Tech Bites. And, there are people there a lot of the other times, but probably not talking about the show. You can get our podcasts on the website. You can get an IRC client. If you don't have your own IRC client or you don't know how to do that or don't want to mess with it, there is a link on the site that will launch a Java-based one in your browser if you've got the latest version of Java updated on your browser and computer. And the phone number, which will become more valuable as the show progresses, and as we get more desperate for calls, is 713-526-5738. You can start calling and getting in line right now. But, there's a few minutes of our usual pre-call business that we go through before the call part starts. So, including the info shot, which we should be getting to very shortly.
And who does the info shot, Peter?
That would be me from San Antonio.
Oh, my God! Hey, so, and also one other thing to note is that not this Friday, but next Friday is another Geek Gathering.
Yes, and I will be at that one. Which
oh,
cool. Is,
oh, awesome. Well, everybody else needs to come then if Peter's going to be there to see that Peter is real.
Or stay away and protest if you don't like the info shots.
The Geek Gatherings are held at Cons, which is at the corner of Milam and Drew in the southern part of Midtown. And it is each time it has gotten better and better and better. This is an excellent location. These have been great Geek Gatherings. There's been a food truck the last two times. And I suspect you should definitely come out to see what Jim Thompson has been doing with his Blinken box, because he's got this Android-powered fishing tackle box that he has been bringing to each of the Geek Gatherings, and each time it's got something else new.
It started with some blinky lights. It's progressed. I expect he'll actually drive the toolbox to the Geek Gathering within a few months.
This be the one where it becomes sentient?
I think so.
Ooh.
The last time he had – the first time it had blinking lights – the next time he had hooked up a telephone to it so that when he dialed it, it would change the order of the lights. And that was just the ultimate level of geek as far as I'm concerned.
That's right. Well, doing it yourself, putting your hands on it, making it do whatever you can make it do. That is absolutely geek.
The big requests are for him to do something with sound in it. So we'll see.
I think that is the next.
We'll see
step.
If he rises to the challenge. So that's a week from this Friday at Cons, wine, coffee, darts, beer,
Wi-Fi, all that.
And it starts usually about 7:30, a week from Friday.
We'll have something on the internet. Jay'll put together some kind of cool flyer. Speaking of Jay's, usually when he's gone, he's usually out of the country, which means that we can act with full impunity because there's no way he could get back in time to actually, you know, hunt us down or reprimand us. But now he's not that far away.
No, he's not that far.
He is within striking distance.
He is within striking distance. But, you know, I imagine he's going to want to stay there.
There aren't many things we can do short of, like, maybe posting a picture and not crediting him. That's like the J signal. It's
That's right. Post a picture.
I'm totally going to do that.
So, Pete, do we
I'm
have
paint
that?
A picture during the show that's actually one of Jay's, and I'm not going to credit him.
I felt a disturbance in the floor. So the thousands of people looking at a picture that wasn't credited.
Imagine,
to me.
If you will, this great shot of downtown Houston from the northwest side looking out with like a really nice filter effect on it at dusk.
Oh, that sounds great.
And be sure you put it on a website on which you intend to make money.
Yeah, I didn't know you were a realtor, Flick.
All right, so Peter, you have some news?
I do have the info shot. If we hit the button and I hear the right stuff, then we'll do it.
Uh-oh. This isn't going to play the right stuff. This is going to play the intro for the info shot.
Take it away, info shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Remember last year when there was SOPA, the big bill that, you know, everybody kind of rose up against and defeated that was going to kind of wreck the internet? Well, it never goes away. It's a zombie. But now it's called CISPA, because they've decided to change the focus to be cyber intelligence. It's the Cyber Intelligence Sharing Protection Act, or CISPA. And the other thing that's a little different is last year with SOPA, you heard Google and a lot of other big companies step up and speak against it, where this time, crickets. The other thing that happened this time is the people who want CISPA spent $84 million lobbying to get it passed, which worked very well in the House of Representatives because it just passed by a 288-127 margin, which is worse than it was last time. And, you know, a sad part is 40 more Democrats voted for it than did last time with SOPA. So that's not good. On the plus side, the Senate is where it is. So after it passed the House, you know, then of course, you've all seen the thing about I'm just a bill. The next place it goes is the Senate, except it's not like on the little 3-minute cartoon where it passes through the Senate and goes off to the president, who has said he would veto this bill. The Senate is a place that makes molasses look like it moves quickly. And so they have not debated the bill, and they've given no indication that the proposal is any kind of priority, as other major issues, including gun control and immigration, linger in the national consciousness. CISPA co-sponsor Rep. Mike Rogers, Republican of Michigan, of the House Intelligence Committee, has maintained the law would help corporations defend against cyber attacks by striking, quote, that right balance between our privacy, civil liberties, and stopping bad guys in their tracks from ruining what is 1/6 of the U.S. economy, unquote, where he was quoted by the Associated Press. Basically, if it were to become a law, it would grant businesses and the government an unprecedented ability to share data with each other without the need to consider antitrust or classification laws. Hacked businesses would be granted legal immunity if they acted in, quote, good faith, unquote, to protect their networks, thanks to a part of the bill whose broad language has drawn the ire of consumer and privacy advocates. Like I mentioned before, an initial version of the bill passed last year and then failed in the Senate. Last year I said 40 support, that there were 40 more that supported it. It actually was more than that. Last year only 40 Democrats supported the bill, but now it's moved up to 92. And the main thing followed the lobbying effort. And who spent the money? The $84 million? Viacom, Time Warner, Verizon, and others, according to Daily Tech. The EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the American Civil Liberties Union are two of CISPA's chief opponents. They've warned that the legislation would reveal health records, credit information, and other info to the government without first being scrubbed by the companies turning over those files. The NSA could then be granted access to those transmissions when investigating foreign hackers. Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft are among the tech companies that have supported the bill, but public backing has slowly eroded after Facebook revoked its support and a series of amendments in the House Intelligence Committee failed to sway the ACLU. So, basically the EFF and ACLU still find big problems with this bill. If it overcomes the odds in the Senate, which seems unlikely, a presidential veto probably means that we'll be back in 2014 talking about, I don't know what they'll call it next, but it'll be son of CISPA and SOPA and so on. In happier news, this was an interesting one I came across that was in The Economist, of all publications, a big technology thing. But the author raised some interesting points. He was talking about going wireless, and beyond Wi-Fi, he was talking about going wireless for more of the higher speed connections that we don't usually think about, like between your computer and its monitor, if they're separate things on yours. And also talking about higher speed Wi-Fi, at the point when you hit where the wireless is faster than Ethernet. Ethernet can get gigabit Ethernet, but they're talking about moving Wi-Fi to 60 gigahertz radio chips eventually, and when those start showing up in everything, then hardwired connections will be hard pressed to compete. He talks about the 60 gigahertz band is in the EHF, extremely high frequency part of the spectrum. Beyond that part of the spectrum is infrared and visible light, just to give you an idea of where they stand on the electromagnetic spectrum. The reason that it's available, since bandwidth usually spectrum is expensive and all that, the reason that it was not commercialized is because governments considered that part of the spectrum worthless. One of the things that's an issue with it, with some of this, is the distance that it can travel is very short. So you can get a lot of bandwidth, but only for short distances. Now, some things, that's an advantage. And so it's one of those things where the problem turns into an advantage. You could get things, you know, there's been some wireless connections like Wireless Home Digital Interface, WHDI, Wireless USB, WiDi, AirPlay. You know, maybe you've heard of some of those. Most of those use the Wi-Fi range, and so they can't really take high amounts of data. The two wireless technologies that he mentioned, or you know, that the this article mentions that are of interest is wireless HD, which is an industry-led initiative, has been around since about 2008. The other, a standard backed by the IEEE, known as WiGig, published its specification in 2010. In IEEE technology, WiGig is known as 802.11ad. For those of you who like to know what the who specify your home Wi-Fi based on its 802 number. Anyways, they broadly do the same thing. In their present incarnations, both are capable of transmitting data at around 7 gigabits a second, 10 times faster than the slickest Wi-Fi today, and have peak data rates around 30 gigabits a second. Future versions of both are expected to raise the peak rates much higher. For comparison, transferring uncompressed high-def video from, say, a Blu-ray player to an HD TV set requires about 3.5 gigabits a second. So you're talking about a huge amount of data at a high rate of speed. And then, you know, talking about why they do their stuff. One of the things is that range problem, which works great for short range stuff. But apparently they've come up with some pencil thin beam solutions that that sounds certainly high tech. So it could be that, you know, your desk, a lot of those cables, other than, say, the power cable, may be going away, and we will definitely keep an eye on the increases in Wi-Fi. We've talked about some of the other ones, which was long distance stuff, but the long distance ones, yeah, they have more bandwidth, but they certainly weren't in the 30 gigabit per second category, which would make a very big difference in computing. In Apple stuff, and no, this isn't rumory things, this is like actual, no product announcements, so that, because then my report that doesn't have rumors could spawn rumors. The big thing was Apple had their financial results thing, blah blah blah, whatever, you know, stock market stuff, whatever. Don't really care. The thing that was interesting was, of course, then there were comments from Tim Cook, who's running Apple, and one of the things he spoke about was a larger screened phone, because there's been lots of talk about that. His comments during the call indicate the company's not quite ready to make a phone with a 5-inch screen. He said, quote, "My view continues to be that the iPhone 5 has the best display in the industry. We always strive to create the very best display. Some customers value large screen size. Others value other factors such as resolution, color quality, white balance, reflectivity, power consumption, compatibility of apps, and portability. Our competitors have made some significant trade-offs in many of these areas to ship a larger display. We would not ship a larger display iPhone while these trade-offs exist." Translated into English, they're not going to build a 5-inch screen until it's up to their standard, until it's up to a level where it's a bigger screen that looks as good as the current iPhone 5 Retina and does all the things that they want in the way that they want. You have that one straight from the horse's mouth, and I don't think this is some kind of game where then suddenly they'll unveil it. They're not going to do it until they feel that it can be done right. And then the other thing that did come out about the it's financially stuff, but it does tie to the technology. One of the things is they're talking, you know, their profits were down, and the reason is because the products that they're selling the most of are products that have lower profit margins. For instance, the iPad Mini. They said it was one of the reasons that their profits dropped, that they went down. Now, they're in no danger of going out of business. If I had a company, I would love to have profits of $9.5 billion for a quarter. But last year, at the same time, it was $11.6 billion. So, and their revenue was up. So, in other words, they sold more stuff. They sold more in total dollars, but they didn't make as much money in profit. So that meant they sold a lot more stuff, but they made less per unit. And apparently the reason that part of the reason for that was because the iPad mini has a lower profit margin than everything else that Apple sells, but they're willing to keep doing that because they feel like that it's got value for the future. So it's the other thing, and now we're into rumory territory. Obviously, at this call, nobody from Apple said when's the next iPhone going to be released or any of those kinds of things. But based on some of the stuff with what they've talked, they have to talk about what they think their revenue is going to do, which gives some hints. It sounds like more things are going to lean towards the fall. The other thing that, so that would mean new products coming out then, so then the revenue comes then. Let's see, Macworld is going to, they announced the dates for Macworld, which is going to be in June like it always is. And the other thing that Tim Cook said is that there are several new categories of device that they haven't made before that are going to come out this year. So if I was going to guess, I mean, basically what everybody thinks is that means that the watch and the TV, those would be the two things that would be the possibilities. Now, maybe there's something else where they're just going to totally surprise us. But so that's kind of your update on the Apple-y stuff. And then let's see some other new things coming. Google Glass. This was an interesting one. Google Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt said that Google Glass won't go on sale until approximately 1 year's time. There were rumors that it had them launching by the end of the year or even the beginning of next year, but apparently to get them to consumers, it's going to be more like they think that it's more than a year. So those of you who were just itching to have your wearable specs, your Google Glass to bring to the next to one of the geek gatherings, it looks to me like next summer might be the geek gathering that you would bring your Google Glass to and show it to us and tie it into the Blinken box and so on. And other new stuff as far as dates of things, Microsoft is going to announce the next generation Xbox on May 21st. If you're into the gaming area, it's 8 years since the first Xbox 360 units shipped, and so now the successor will be announced on May 21st. They've got a press event scheduled for 10 a.m. Pacific time at the Redmond headquarters that's going to be live streamed on the web, Xbox Live, Xbox.com, and Spike TV. They say that, quote, on that day we'll share our vision for Xbox and give you a real taste of the future. Then they'll talk about their console games a few weeks after that. In the middle of June, right around the same time as Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, is the Electronic Entertainment Expo, generally known as E3. And so there'll be more stuff with that. Plus, we'll kind of have the head-to-head of announcements about stuff at E3 for Sony with the PlayStation 4. So it's getting exciting on the console front if you're a console type gamer for that. And finally, on the new stuff, this one I guess the reason I would consider it as new is because now you can actually purchase it and it's not a beta. Swipe has dropped the beta tag and is now official. So this is for Android. You can get it in the Play Store. It's easy to install and it's, on the flip side, no longer free. Sadly, developers at Nuance, the company which purchased Swipe in 2011, deem it finished. The latest version of the Android keyboard, 1.5, and ready. They say it's finished and ready for full public consumption. It doesn't sound like it's that different. If you've been doing the betas, it's not that different than the last release. It's $1 if you want to buy it from the Play Store. So we're not talking about, yes, they're putting it up for sale, but the difference between beta and free and $1, well, that's sort of infinite. But on the other hand, you don't have to go sign up for the software and, you know, the limitations of signing up, you know, of installing beta software from unknown sources. So now you can get it the official way and do the swipe thing. That's the one where it keeps track. You just sort of, you slide your finger from one key to another, and it uses sort of the pattern of that to know the word that you're typing. And I know several people who've said that it's been very effective for them, and they like swipe. Like I said, its competitor is SwiftKey. So if you use SwiftKey, or if you've looked at that and are thinking about an alternative, you may want to look at swipe. You can get the beta for free if you're for now. Still, if you want to try it out for nothing, or you can spend the buck if you're interested in it. And that's the news.
And thank you for that news, Peter. Hey, you left something out, Peter.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was the completely comprehensive, left no stone unturned, no detail. Now what did I miss?
You didn't talk about the release of the Galaxy S4, which is all the reviews dropped last night, and the and it's going to be available on this weekend.
Cool. Yeah, I have a hard time following all of the Android phones. I don't get review units, so I don't have that. I'm not as tied into that, so it's a little harder to.
Arguably, that's the Android
phone.
That
is the Android.
Although,
phone.
Dwight's what Dwight has again, this HTC One is pretty sweet.
Sweet. The Galaxy S4 is kind of like a Galaxy S3, but more, a little bigger, more bells and whistles. What's funny is it's so complex, it has so many features, that it has an easy mode.
Just put it in noob and try it
that's
again.
That's right, put it in noob and try it again. So that's it. Yeah, I was curious to see what you're going to say about that, so I wanted to.
Yeah, I didn't stumble on, I saw where there were some of the reviews in that, but didn't see anything where it struck me to.
A lot of the reviewers who had tried the HTC One, which is out now, and I reviewed it today in my blog, are kind of disappointed in this because it's just as plasticky and slippery and you know, made
it
the way.
It feels cheap. Still,
right,
that's what
right.
I heard.
It feels cheap.
Let me ask you this. So if you had had the Galaxy S4 in your hands when it was time to decide between the iPhone or an Android phone, would you?
Well, I haven't actually held an S4.
Okay.
Specs-wise, I haven't tried one yet.
Specs-wise,
I don't put much. I don't put much stock in just specs. It's the experience of using the phone, and you know the HTC One, which actually kind of looks like the iPhone 5 a little bit
cleaner.
A little bit cleaner has pretty good specs, and it's very fast. I mean, it's fast, does everything, you know, almost instantaneously, and so I'm fine with the speed of this. But this just looks so much better. It feels so much better. It's got some serious build quality to it that Samsung phones don't have. And in fact, I think it was The Verge's review of the S4 in which the guy basically said that every time he would hand it to somebody, they'd make this kind of face like, ew, you know, because it's slippery and slick on the back. And people kind of didn't like holding it. So
if you gave Barrett an S3, that could lead to, like, the best viral video of all time.
whoop. Oops.
Well, you know, if you walk into a store and there's, like, the Galaxy S4 and there's the HTC One next to it, and you pick them up and just hold them together, you know, there's kind of no contest.
Well, no, I wanted to like the Galaxy S3. I carried one for a little while, but it just felt every time I would take the back off, I thought I was going to break it. It just felt that.
Yeah, the back
cheap.
Is very thin, right.
So I didn't like that. I like, you know, the double glass side of the Nexus 4. I really like how the HTC One feels with the metal.
Groovehouse, you've got an S3, don't you?
Yes, I do.
How do you like it?
I like it a lot, except lately it started to kind of get slow on me. The keyboard takes forever to pop up and doesn't react real fast.
Huh.
Not sure what's going on there.
Yeah, well, you might need to do the Jay Lee maneuver on it.
Reinstall my software.
Reinstall Windows.
On my Android phone. Yeah.
All right, so the phone number is 713-526-5738 if you want to join our party, or 713-526-KPFT for those who prefer the alphabet. We take your calls. Groovehouse, We'll screen you, and then we'll start answering questions.
All the lines are open. You can be first on the show.
That's right. This is a Jay Lee free show, so if you are intimidated, frightened, if when you hear Jay's voice, you crawl under the desk and curl up in a fetal position, this is your opportunity.
Don't come in IRC, though, because he's hanging on IRC.
Oh, he's in IRC?
He's actually, yeah, he's listening to you, Dwight.
Awesome. 713-526-5738.
But he won't hear you for about 20 seconds, so.
So I can leave now.
So you can get out. No, Jay.
So what about NASA sending the phones up, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's right. NASA launched three Nexus, I think there were Nexus 1 smartphones into space in little metal cubes. And I don't remember exactly what they're doing. Have you read the story, Barrett?
No.
Or Afflicted?
They were testing them to see if they could use off-the-shelf components to make satellites for communication.
Right. And they'll last for a little while, and then they are going to fall to Earth and burn up.
Oh, that's how they're going to burn up. That could be a really cool, like, you know, real-life Angry Birds situation. You know,
yes, seriously.
It's clever on their part to do. I had, you know, obviously when you work in Houston, you always have coworkers. You inevitably in technology have coworkers who worked at NASA in one form or another. And talking about the tech, kind of the processors in that, you know, getting into detail that you don't usually, you know, unless there's a big deep article about it. You know, they stayed, because of their standards for stuff, they stayed way behind. You know, they wanted a product that was bulletproof and had been for a long, long time and had all the bugs, you know, virtually all the bugs worked out. And so they were using, you know, long after we'd all moved on to PowerPC and so on, they were using like Motorola 68000 processors and things like that. And I guess it's wise on their part to test kind of current technology with no modification and see how well it works. I mean, obviously, the cost to lug it up to space and put it out there is substantial, but the cost compared to most of their programs to test it out, to try it out, is really kind of cheap.
There've been a ton of like hobbyists though putting like cell phones and putting Arduinos and putting things up into arguably almost like extremely low orbit, you know, with weather balloons and getting them up there extremely high to where, you know, the electronics start to freeze over. And
do we need
really
to start
well.
A Kickstarter for the Blinken box to go to space?
I think that's an excellent
that would
idea.
Be
and,
cool.
You know, Jim Thompson does software for spacecraft. So
we need to send his toolbox up and then log it.
Absolutely.
Have it talk back to Earth.
So I'm reading the story, and it doesn't. One of the things I'm curious about is how exactly does it communicate? I guess they have radio signals from the satellites. Ham radio operators have been picking up signals already from it. So, and they'll be up there for 2 weeks before they come back and burn up in the atmosphere. So,
didn't they send it up on that new company's rocket?
Orbital Science Corp's Antares rocket.
Yeah.
Lifted off from the Wallops Island Flight Facility in Virginia. So on Sunday.
It was, I think it was the first full flight of that craft. Like the first, you know, actual like attempt to launch, and it was successful.
713-526-5738 if you want to join us. Put a Groove House to work. He'll take your calls and we'll get you on the air as fast as we can. 713-526-KPFT. I also saw another space video. SpaceX has a little craft called the Grasshopper. And they did this test. The video shows it taking off, and it rises a couple hundred feet in the air and then hovers on a column, a pillar of flame, and then slowly lowers back down to Earth. And obviously, what they're more interested in testing the landing capability of it. But it was beautiful. I mean, it went up and it came down, and the shot was from above, and the flame kind of spread out as it came back down on the pad and then shut down. And very science fiction looking. It didn't look real.
That's pretty cool. I did some more research on the satellites and phones. So, I mean, does Apple have any phones in space? Or no?
No, because they'd have to they'd have to license. They have
to pay a license. This is pretty cool, too. They went up in a CubeSat with the containers. You're asking about the propulsion. And that actually controls, like, the attitude and orbital controls. And that's running Linux, actually. So it's
Linux.
No, no, no. I mean the controls on top of the thing that's actually surrounding the phone is Linux, too. Double Linux.
And they said that for the antenna, they use, like,
a Pringles can?
Piece of carpenter's, a piece of metal from a carpenter's tape measure. So they were trying to go like as cheap as possible off the shelf.
Did they really do that?
Yeah, that's
what it looks like. I'm looking at a picture, but
in one of the articles, that's what it said.
And the box was made out of stolen hubcaps or
nano satellites. Yeah, they're trying to get a sub $10,000 satellite up there. That's pretty cool.
Well, and it's, you know, one of the things that the privatization of space has done is it has forced all the players to look at doing things cheaper, faster, you know, again, off the shelf. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that NASA would have gone to kind of this low-ball approach, you know, years ago would have been unthinkable back when they were essentially flying a giant pickup truck into space.
I think it's a little bit safer, too, to be working with unmanned, you know, projects because, worst case, you lose, you know, you lose your cell phone.
You just lose your
phone.
Which
I do all the time. That's not a big deal. Yeah.
I
hope we got the insurance on that.
That's right. And I hope it doesn't land in the water because the insurance doesn't cover water damage.
NASA was,
and hopefully they don't ask, where did you lose your phone?
Ionosphere, I think. I'm not entirely sure.
So 713-526-5738. We need your calls. We want your calls. We're not fundraising, but we want to talk to you. So, Peter, you got anything interesting outside the news to tell us?
No. Well, I don't know if you were listening during the news, but the one one of the stories was about more wireless on the desktop, as far as using like high bandwidth, short range Wi-Fi to high frequency stuff to get rid of more of the cables. And I've been on a battle with my desk to get to that. I have not reached Apple Nirvana where you have, you know, where you can't see any of the cables, even if the ones you have to use. And so seeing something like that obviously caught my eye. And, the thing is, some of the stuff, the higher frequency stuff, the problem is it doesn't go long distance as well. But that's a feature if you're talking about your video from your computer to your monitor. You know, you don't want that to be available 300 feet away from your computer, you know, so you could, because you couldn't have 10 of them in a room and have it work. But I hadn't heard it in a while. I hadn't heard anybody talking about it in a while, but it sounds like one of those things that quietly behind the scenes has been moving forward. And so, you know, as I sit at my desk with a Bluetooth keyboard and a Bluetooth magic pad, trackpad, then I may have a, you know, wireless monitor or a, you know, all my devices with no wires in between them. Then I've got to figure out how to charge them without them.
So what are you using, a Mac Mini or an iMac?
I have an iMac.
Which year?
Oh, it's one. It's verging towards, I think, in next year is going to be replacement time. It's a 24-inch, and it's from, I think, 2008.
Yeah, that's about the same one I have. Yeah, and next year we won't. Neither of us will probably be able to use the next upgrade in OS X.
Yeah, and it's starting to. I've just recently it's starting to have some issues where it gets to where the things I'm doing in a normal day are using up more memory. I've got the full 8 gigs that it can take, and it's starting to max out and use virtual memory, which like slows it down and makes it kind of painful to use.
So have you tried wiping your drive and starting fresh?
No, not recently with this one, but that would be if it gets too much, if it happens too much more often, where it gets to where it's it was using a huge amount of scratch disk and was like really bogging, especially on mail. And if it does that again, then I would consider, like, just go fresh on it and see if that solves it.
When I replaced my hard drive in my iMac a couple of weeks ago, I considered doing that. I considered starting fresh, particularly when I was thinking about using an SSD, which had been much lower capacity. But I decided, because I didn't want to have the limitation on the size, I went ahead and bought a hard drive and just just did a restore back to that drive. So essentially I have all my old problems back. It still runs pretty good, but I'm really tempted to wipe it.
I'm surprised. I know you, well, you, since you didn't go SSD, why you didn't go with maybe one of the hybrids, or is yours not supported on that?
No, it would have supported it. I decided that I'm probably not going to. Hybrid disks are still relatively expensive compared to just a standard disk, and since I don't know how much longer I'll have this machine, it may not last another year. Just because I'll want to get the latest version of OS X, I decided I didn't want to invest that much into it.
I'm seriously thinking about a Hackintosh for my next one, though. I mean, I like the iMac in that, but I would like to get a good monitor, good pair of monitors, and then just swap out the box that feeds them.
Yeah, as much as I love the way the iMacs look, particularly the new ones are just, they're completely unserviceable unless you want to upgrade memory. That's about it. So I'm thinking that I may do a Mac Mini on the next one.
You wonder why they haven't come out with something in the middle between the Mac Mini and the iMac, because the Minis, they tend to sort of detune them a bit. Although with Thunderbolt and some of these other new things, it starts opening up, you know, it's got enough horsepower to hook up more things to it.
Well, and in the current Mac Mini, it comes with the Fusion Drive option, which is the combination of a small SSD and combined with a hard drive. It essentially uses RAID to combine them. And that was pretty fast in the 21-inch iMac I tried, and I imagine it's pretty sweet in a Mac Mini, too.
The other thing I'd seriously consider, the other way I'd consider going is get a Mac Mini or maybe get more than one and use, like, Synergy so that then you're dividing up the work. You know, basically you put your mail or whatever on one machine and the, like, direct stuff put the kind of social media and some of those kinds of things off on one and then the heavy load stuff on another, or else balance them out, you know?
Well, that's one way to do it. 713-526-5738. If you want to be on the air, we have a caller.
Groovehouse.
All right.
Yes.
Who do we have?
All right, up first on the show, we are going to speak with Adam.
Hey, Adam, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. How you doing today?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, although I've got another slightly broken hard drive, so it sounds like that's a popular topic for the night.
It's a popular topic every night.
So I'm it's a PC. It's a Frankenstein. I've been slowly upgrading and amalgamating over the last 10 years or whatever. And there were some shenanigans going on in my house while my computer was booting up, and it took a rather sharp blow to the side of the computer while it was in mid-boot. So that was kind of the last time it booted properly. I have since, it was a Western Digital hard drive. I don't know if the serials or if the model is useful for you, but I remember that. But I've since switched over, bought a little 120 gig SSD just to kind of check it out. I'm really liking that. I'm really enjoying the 12-second boot time.
Hmm.
But the old hard drive was an old 1 terabyte Western Digital. And that had pretty much all of my, you know, photos, data, save game files, all that kind of stuff from back in the day. And I've since tried opening that via a USB 2 hard drive adapter to turn it into an external drive.
Right.
And it shows no data. It shows up as like a 100 meg empty drive now.
How large is the actual drive? It's a lot larger than 100 megs.
Oh, it was a terabyte, and it was probably 70-80% full.
And so after the bump to the side, the machine would boot up, and it would say non-system disk error, or what would it do?
It would hang in blue screen. It would get through the BIOS fine, but it would hang in blue screen. First of all, I'd get it into Windows a couple times, but it would be ungodly slow. I got it into safe mode once or twice, and it kind of worked, so I thought that something might be repairable. We tried the Windows repair, just reinstalling Windows, all of that, and it just failure after failure after failure.
Did you, when you had it in safe mode, were you able to see your files?
I was able to see the desktop, and yeah, I was able to see the files at that point.
Well, so the drive was working well enough to actually be able to boot into Windows. So did it show the normal size of the drive, or did you go check that out?
I didn't think to check that at the time. I've been trying to find. Somebody told me to look into hard drive data recovery software, but honestly, I know worse than nothing about that.
One of the best products that I know of for fixing this on your own, although I don't think it's cheap, is called SpinRite. SpinRite, and it works down at the machine level. And if anything can save your disk, it can. You know, one of the issues with a physical blow is that if the write head banged into the platter and scraped magnetic data away, it's possible, you know, that you're screwed. Now, one of the things SpinRite can do is SpinRite can kind of find the data and reconstruct it.
It'll work around those parts and just give you like some null data instead of just crashing entirely.
Right. The other thing is the last time you used it, you said you've been able to boot into Windows.
I was briefly, although then it quit doing that and I just got fed up and unplugged it.
Right. What happens is every time you use a damaged disk, particularly if there's some other issue where it's not performing properly, you write more crap onto the disk.
Or even if you've got like a failing, you know, disk write head or something like that, if something in the internal mechanism is starting to give way mechanical, each time you use that, you're taking some of its longevity and it's going to crash sooner. So usually what you want to do is you want to don't do anything whatsoever, hands off, don't boot it, and then go into rescue mode.
Right. Probably when you went into safe mode, what you should have done immediately was copied those files off while you could see them. That would have been your safest thing.
Yeah, I didn't realize I was quite that bad off at the time.
Well, the suggestion I would make is to use something like SpinRite, unless Barrett, you've got...
No, I mean, I've used... there's another product called Easus. You could try that, but I wouldn't try each one. I wouldn't give it more than one pass. If it doesn't get the data right away, at that point, you might want to start considering, you know, getting some professional help.
Although that's not cheap.
Although that is extremely expensive, to the tune of 3 to 4 figures easy.
Okay, then.
How valuable was the data on the disk? I mean, is this stuff you have to get back, or is it more of an inconvenience if you lose the
data? It's all of a personal nature, just family photos from the last several years, that kind of stuff.
And you didn't have a backup?
No, it's one of those things that you keep meaning to and never quite get around to it.
But now you will, right?
Yeah, pretty
assuredly. There's a Houston data recovery. Who does Jay usually give
on
out?
OnTrack is who he
is. Is it OnTrack?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, you can always Google for OnTrack, and they might be able to help you out, too, if you don't get very far with SpinRite or Easus.
What was the second data recovery?
Easus? It's like EASUS, like EASEUS. If you Google for Easus hard drive recovery, I'm sure it'll be the first hit. Right.
Is it S or Z?
I think it's, you know, I don't know. SpinRite, I would try SpinRite first because, like Dwight said, that actually, it can actually spin the platters in such a way it can route around damaged parts on the disk. If it's something mechanical is wrong with it, SpinRite might be your better choice, although it is a little bit pricier.
Yeah, SpinRite is SpinRite.
Okay. And is it something I'll have to plug into the IDE cable or to the SATA cable, or is that something I can use with it adapted as a USB 2?
You can do it as you probably can run it through. It'll work with almost any drive. So I think what you do is you create a boot disk with it, and it boots, and then works from there. If I'm not mistaken, it's made by Gibson Research, Steve Gibson, who's pretty well-known programmer from the old school, and he can. It's a pretty good program.
Have you considered dropping an extra sawbuck and getting an external drive that you could use for regular backups going forward?
That's what I've got now. When dropped a couple more, just basically empty terabyte drives in there that I'm going to use for backups now.
Yeah, SpinRite is $89.
And I was just gonna say some crank on IRC is saying that Easus is spelled with S's. There's no Z.
Ah, good to know.
Hack the Gibson.
Right, and Easus, and then failing that, on track here in Houston.
Or, man, you know, just don't worry about backups and keep living on the edge.
Just memorize all your data. Look at it before you go to bed. It'll be fine.
Just treat it as an exercise in Buddhism and Buddhism and the impermanence of life. How about that?
Buddhism.
Yes, with a T.
All right, guys.
All right, well, good luck, Adam.
Thanks.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Good night.
Yeah, that's really painful. That's really painful.
Don't wait until that happens to you to start backing up. Like, listen to Adam's pain and listen to other stories and seriously start backing up, because it, chances are, it will happen to you.
When my hard drive on this iMac died, you know, I had been using Time Machine, and I was just really, really nervous that the backup wouldn't work, you know, because you all hear stories about people with who have backups and then they don't back up their stuff. I have a secondary backup, but I don't do that as often as I rely on Time Machine. Time Machine worked great, and what I was able to do was connect my I had another hard drive, a laptop drive, and I connected it via USB to my iMac, then used the Time Machine drive and recovered to this external drive. And so it put my image on there, and then I just booted from that. And I actually ran that way for several days, booting to an external drive with my old image. It was exactly as it left it before it crashed. So I was then able to take, again, the Time Machine backup. And when I got my new drive that I was going to put in, I put that on an external connection, copied the image to that, and so that when I put the new drive in, I just fired the iMac up, and it was like nothing had happened.
That all sounds very complicated, but Apple makes it
very
easy.
Simple,
right? Yeah, it's just a few clicks.
Right. And by, you know, whatever device that you have, if it has data, you should find a way to back it up, and don't wait for something like this to happen. 713-526-5738 is our number. Give us a call and join us.
And to fill the time, something, you know, that I wanted to quiz the panel on, because I've run up against this lately for a few different people, and so I've been thinking about it more, is one of the things that's interesting to me is email. It seems to me that email is kind of broken unless you pay attention and kind of manage it, because it's so easy to accumulate tremendous amounts of email and do nothing with it. So it just sits there, and then your machine starts working slower, because I don't think that a lot of email clients are really built to handle, you know, 25 gigabytes of mail, or they don't seem to, that you often end up running into problems. And I just wonder, you know, at some point it seems like the ability to have so much mail that the client can't really handle it is not a far out concept anymore, because everybody seems to want all their mail all the time, every piece of mail they ever got since two computers ago, because that all follows them. You know, I support, there are different users that I support around, and you know, that's sort of the first thing they want, is all of their email
and all their attachments too. That's the big thing we're finding is the salespeople, they'll email, you know, hey, here's a 30 meg PowerPoint presentation, uncompressed. Let's forward it around where everybody can look at it. And suddenly, you know, two users have eaten up, you know, 500 megs of storage.
Right. Well,
don't,
and that's
why. Don't do that, people.
That's one of the reasons why I love web-based mails, because mm-hmm. all those issues go away when you start relying pretty much on web-based.
Just mail. Get rid of email altogether, Peter. Just go Twitter only. If you can't get on 44, you just,
since they're businesses, and you know, it's the kind of thing where, as I'm supporting them with this stuff, that's sort of a paid job. Then you have to sort of keep the customer happy. Some of it is that their mail, you know, some of them, the mail's on the server now. And so they have, you know, they're using IMAP, so you kind of get the equivalent of, you know, web and cloud mail. But a lot of businesses, you might not want to put your mail on the cloud.
No, I think most people want to continue. So we got a lot of calls in the queue suddenly, and we've got just a few minutes before we got to go to the first break. So Groove, can you queue us one up, or are you actually on the phone?
Yes, let's take one real quick here. We'll take Sandy.
Sandy, you're on the air with Tech Bytes. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you. You're going to laugh, but I have an antique computer, a compact Presario that's new, never been out of the box. And I'm short on funds thanks to the sequester cutting off my unemployment, and I need to sell it. Am I going to be able to sell that antique?
What,
they
what's
have
the
upgrades
model number?
All over the computer for the memories.
What's the model number? Do you know?
SR1103WM-B.
Compaq SR1103?
Dash V is in victory or D is in double?
WM, B is in bundle. Or
neither. B is in Bravo. Got it.
When you say it's still in the box, how old is it?
You should tell me from the model number. I'm thinking 2006 maybe is what I saw on the computer.
That's not quite antique-y.
Yeah,
that's not that old anymore. Computers made, even 7 years ago will still work pretty well now.
The problem is it's old in terms of its value.
I've never taken it out of the box.
You could go on, maybe list it on eBay. Maybe the best bet.
I don't have an eBay. Is there another way?
Well, eBay is just a website. You can sign up for an account and put it on there.
Oh, you don't have to have credit cards and all that stuff?
You can use PayPal.
Okay. Can I Google that and find out about that?
Sure. eBay has some good tutorials on how to sell something.
Yeah, they should have a walkthrough on how to create the account and how to link it up to PayPal.
You could also put it on
like
Craigslist if you want to sell it locally.
Well, my son has put something on Craigslist for me because he knows how to do that, and he has a laptop. Is it worth anything? I mean,
One of the things you could do, for example, let's go to eBay.
Are you allowed to tell me what you think it might be worth?
Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to eBay. I'm going to type in this model number.
Oh, okay.
It was compact.
There's a WM, and then there's another one that's WMB, and I have the WMB.
Okay. Well,
I feel like this is like Antiques Roadshow.
It
this
is.
Fun.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's an antique.
Let's see. I see a lot of. I see a lot of computer parts.
I think your computer was built during the Civil War era. We're seeing
interesting
markings here.
I don't see the computer itself, at least not in the initial. Let's do it this way.
Because most of them have been trashed for better ones. But the fact that it's new, does that add anything?
The fact that it's new in box might take some trepidation out of someone buying an older computer because it's never been opened,
That's what I was thinking.
But at the same time, it's one of those things where it's not quite antique, like, oh, wow, that's a VIC-20 new in box. It would be worth a lot of money. It's just kind of like a slightly older computer in probably the depths of its value right now.
The fact that you can buy an older Compaq Presario desktop.
And we got to go out in a second. Do you want to hang on, Sandy, and we can come back to you? We've got to take care of some station business, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Is that 3-0? That's 30 seconds left. So I guess we need to wrap it up here.
Okay, well, I guess we don't need to introduce ourselves going out, do we?
Oh, we got 20 seconds to your call, Pete.
Should we?
Actually, I think we do introduce ourselves going out. Let's just do it for the hell of it.
We'll be back after this. I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's
Groovehouse. Be back in just a moment.
The Orange Show Center for Visionary Art presents the 26th annual Houston Art Car Parade, free to all, on Saturday, May 11th. Bring the whole family out bright and early as the starting line party revs up at 9 a.m. on Taft Street at Allen Parkway, with live music and fun for kids and adults. At 1 p.m., the world's oldest and largest art car parade will roll, presenting a lineup of 300 mobile masterpieces. For information about the entire Houston Art Car Parade weekend, visit orangeshow.org. This is KPFT Houston.
Someone you know own a local dining establishment? KPFT has a pledge drive coming up, and each drive, restaurants in the area feed our phone volunteers who give of their time to help KPFT reach its goals. Donations of food by these establishments are tax deductible and help community radio in the process. We also thank your establishment on air. Call 713-526-4000 for more information on how Houston eateries can lend a helping hand to KPFT. Ideal locations will be close to downtown Houston and be able to provide meals for 12 hungry volunteers. Again, that's 713-526-4000 for more information. This is 90.1 Pacifica Radio, kpft.org, twitter.com/kpft, facebook.com/kpfthouston.
And thanks for that, promos.
We're back. We've successfully come through the dark side of the public service announcements. All right, should we pick back up where we were? Or do we
have a baritone? Talking to Sandy about this older computer that's still in the box. Sandy, you there?
Hello,
Sandy. So when you say, has it like never actually been opened? Is it still sealed?
No, I did open the top to look and see what kind of stuff was up there, and my son wanted to see, but I didn't pull everything out. I just left it.
It's only slightly open.
So it's never been plugged in.
Because once you take something out of its original box, you know how much fun it is to Tetris it back in there? I didn't
want to
deal with
that. It
never goes
in the same way as it comes out. So is this the one that actually comes with USB speakers? It's got a flat screen monitor. It has the whole package, or is it just...
17-inch flat screen, and yeah, I think my son said something about, USB, I believe.
Well, there's some good news and there's some bad news. I mean, the good news is I'm seeing, like, the discrete parts of it. For instance, like, on eBay, some of the power supplies for that for, you know, $40, $50, $60, which is kind of cool. Some of the memories, you know, $20 or $30, but our own Jay Lee from Atlanta has done some research, and he's seeing the entire system used from, you know, about $50, $43.99. So that's on eBay. What I would do is maybe just list it higher. You know, worst case is you just relist it at a lower price, you know.
Right.
Or if you're feeling, you know, then I'm sure your son can explain this to you. If he can get something on Craigslist, he can also get something on eBay. You could just, you know, put it out there without a reserve and just go, Jay's saying maybe about $100 on eBay, which I tend to agree. Yeah, I mean, you're getting a lot of stuff. You're getting a monitor, you're getting speakers, you're getting a whole bunch of stuff. So as you put the ad together, make sure you don't just put an item number out there, but, you know, sell it up. Say, hey, you get this, this, and this, and this. Because for a totally turnkey connection, you know, a solution, rather, that's not that bad. Someone could bite at that for $150, $200.
Maybe. Do you know on the outside of the box or any of the materials you have, do you know how much memory it has?
Ooh, no.
Or how big the hard drive is?
No. But I know they sell the memory upgrades for them.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of those, and they're around $50.
Yeah. What I was thinking is that if you could couch it as an inexpensive new computer that somebody could get out of the box, maybe even upgrade to Windows 7 or even Windows 8 actually uses less resources than Windows 7, you might be able to convince somebody that, hey, this is a pretty good bargain if you price it up a little.
The downside, unless I looked it up on the Compaq site to get the specs, and it looks like it's an Intel Celeron processor. That's a strike.
Slow.
256 megs of memory installed, maximum of 1 gig.
Oh god, yeah.
If that's the case, 40 gig hard drive. That doesn't help you.
Well, put it out there, and you can always run
memory,
a computer top.
Well, when he listed it for me, I told him to put on there that memory upgrades are easily available, because there was a whole bunch of lists of memory, looking at the Compaq site. There was a whole bunch of memory upgrades for the Presarios.
Well, good luck with that. The sad thing is, I mean, even worse than, you know, an automobile, the second, you know, you get that computer, it's already getting older and older. There's newer and newer technology coming out.
It takes
such a miserable dive in value. It's almost better just not to look at it, because it hurts to know how much you paid for it than how much you can actually get for it.
Right. Well, I didn't pay anything for it.
Well, there you go.
I just need money so I can go to the art corporation.
And 40 years from now, when you see them on the Antiques Roadshow and they've got one in a box and it's worth $4 million because of inflation, of course, then you can kick yourself because you sold yours for whatever you get now.
That's funny. Okay.
All right, good luck, Sandy.
Well, thank y'all so much.
You're welcome. Good night.
Wish we had better news for you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Groovehouse, who is next?
All right, up next on the show, we are going to speak with Charlie.
Hello,
hi,
Charlie.
Guys. How are you tonight?
How are you guys? How are you doing?
Doing well. Listen, gentlemen, I've got a dumb question. I heard you speaking about an iMac. I'm home from work, have the iMac, which I have, you know, transport back and forth, and I realized I left my my mouse, wireless mouse. It's about a year or so old, my machine. And lo and behold, I dropped my wireless keyboard, and now I'm short the X, the Y key, and the space bar. As I look at my iMac trying to get back online, it's, of course, looking for the Bluetooth mouse, attempting to connect, which it's not going to find because the mouse is in Spring. Is there a way to use the remaining keys on my keyboard to somehow override the mouse search and get on, and then secondarily maneuver a little bit? You guys are way wiser than I.
I think you're better off, well, is Best Buy still open or Target or any of those places, going and getting a USB mouse for $10 or something and hooking that up to it. Or maybe even better, you know, if you have to, go to the store and get duplicates of what you already have, and then you can leave some at home and some at work, and you only have to carry the iMac back and forth.
Yeah, let's invent an iMac pack, shall we, guys?
Have you tried just hitting the escape key on the keyboard?
Well, I'm escaping now, but it's just giving me that cute little Apple sound.
Yes, no, thump the no sound. No.
No. Right now, it reminds me of my great uncle. Always no. Never anything but no. Count on it. Anyway, but gentlemen, I love your show. You do a wonderful job for non-geeks like me, and I thank you.
Well, actually, if Best Buy isn't open, Walgreens and CVS sell cheap mice.
I would think, yeah.
Yeah,
and
they sell
Target,
cheap mice.
Walmart, too.
Yep, Walmart.
I'm on my way.
All right. Late night options. Good luck.
Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Good night, Charlie.
He was going to say, you know, like if anybody would know about, you know, how to use a keyboard with missing keys, it would be Barrett.
Yeah. Virtual keyboards go a long way. The more fun part is I've been losing remotes lately with this last move, remote controls, but a lot of the devices I have, they're internet accessible. So I've been having to, like, you know, like in map, first of all, figure out what subnet they're on, get them on the network in map, and then secure shell in or telnet in, and then control them that way. So it's not easy.
You know, you could get a universal remote.
I thought about that, but that'd be easy. I have one, but it's still in a box somewhere. I've got two.
I did that with the, you know, we moved, and so our provider for getting television changed, and we went with DirecTV, and the we'd had the remotes before. We'd had AT&T and Time Warner, and their remotes were pretty easily programmable for stuff. And the one for Direct just wasn't that good. It wouldn't handle. We have an older receiver. And I got a $50 Harmony remote, and it actually works really, really well.
There's some really cool stuff. I think Logitech makes that. Yeah, they make everything from, like, just the small, thin one, and they actually have displays on them. I had for a while, like, a full-on, it looked like a mini, like an iPad. There was touchscreen, and you can actually program in macros. You can say, hey, I want to watch a movie. And then he was leaving on. I'll say, like, okay, dim the lights, bring up the amp, do this, do that, put it on this input, and make some popcorn. And it almost does everything.
Yeah, they have one that sells for as much as $300.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think they have a new one that's the Ultimate, which is $400, because I looked at it. It looks sweet, but not. I would rather buy new devices to put in my, you know, TV rack than just a remote. But yeah, you hook it up with USB to your computer, and then you can tell it the steps to go through. You know, when you push the button to watch TV, you can tell it all the things it needs to, you know, turn this on and set the receiver to this input and so on. It's pretty slick.
So we still have a good chunk amount of time in the show. We got two people in the bank. We've got three or four open lines at 713-526 5738.
And we have no Barrett time this week.
Oh, you had to call it out. I was slacking because Jay wasn't here, but.
See, and I didn't even say anything.
I know, that's what I mean. We flicked it, did it in the microphone. We were just going to let this thing slide on by. No one was going to be the wiser. And
Pete ratted you out.
And he ratted me out. Jay, I'm afraid to go into IRC now. Okay, maybe well, Jay's not.
You've got about 20 seconds.
Can we hit, is there a 20-second
yeah,
dump
hit
button?
The dump.
Where are the dogs barking when you really, really need them?
Well, all right.
What did Peter say to him?
Groovehouse, who be next?
All right, up next on the show, we are going to speak with Gary.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, what's going on tonight?
Well, I have a very weird question, but let me give you some background. I'll make it quick. About a couple of months ago, I talked to you guys, and I have a very old Dell desktop, and I'm on dial-up, and I noticed that my connections were just getting slower and slower and slower, and I live way out here in the sticks, and our server, I think, with the Facebook overload was affecting it.
Yeah, you called before, right? We've talked to you before.
Yes. And well, anyway, I called 2 weeks ago because my mouse was crapping out, and it's the original Dell mouse, and it's still the light kept going out, and you said that it might be the port or it might be a short in the computer. Well, it turns out it was the mouse. It just completely crapped out. And you told me to go get a Logitech mouse or something, and I went. So here's an update. I went to Target, and I went to Radio Shack. Logitech mice, all they carry are wireless. They range from $20 to $40. So I spent $7.99 on a GE wired mouse, and it's the most incredible thing. I mean, it's so fast that if you move it a quarter of an inch, the cursor goes off the screen. But when I hooked it up and started using it, my computer started working faster, and my pop-ups come up quicker. My startup routine is quicker, and even the Internet seems to be quicker. Is it possible that the old mouse, which was dysfunctional, had anything to do with the speed of the computer? Is that maybe.
And this is totally in the developer thing. Yeah, if you had a flaky drive or if it was going out and just trying to grab stuff, the system isn't supposed to give it more resources than a certain amount, but it could be very possible it's just spinning around and trying to like work with the driver that isn't functioning, and it could be taking away processor cycles. It could be doing other things like helping you browse the web or launch other applications.
Is it? Of course, USB doesn't work the same way, but in the older like the PS2 mice, when they worked on interrupts, and so mm-hmm. it wanted a specific interrupt, and if you had a faulty mouse that had a short in it, it would constantly be hitting the interrupt, and it could be doing the same thing with the USB port.
That's amazing. So for $7.99, I got a new mouse and I fixed my computer at the same time.
That's
possibly,
right.
But everyone else's mileage may vary.
Can I ask another question?
Well, sure, but one thing about the speed, if the speed of your mouse isn't to your liking, there are settings in the control panel for your mouse where you can dial back how responsive it is.
Oh, no, it's fine. I've adjusted to it.
Okay.
I just don't move it that much anymore. We're talking 10 years down the road, so I know the technology is a lot different. But now, this is another strange question. I asked you this before, so I'm not going to mention any names so you guys don't make fun of me. But when I Google my name, there's a certain number of hits there, and it ranges from 2,200,000 to 2,500,000, and it goes up and down, and I notice it kind of corresponds with when I go on to certain blogs and make comments, and I assume people check it out and all of that. So I wanted to ask you, about the frequency of check. Well, the other night I went on, and it went from 2 million to 11 million, and then it went back to 2 million the next day. Now, I know for a fact an additional 9 million people didn't look up my name on Google. So the question is, does Google make mistakes? Can the logarithm, can there be mathematical errors of that magnitude?
No, the short answer
actually,
is...
Actually, I have to confess. Have you ever heard of flash mobs? Have you ever heard of a flash mob?
Yeah, you guys did it to me, didn't you? I knew it. You guys screwed me up. And you went in there and you put on an automatic...
We got 9 million friends, and we all put up websites about it for 5 minutes. And that sounds like a hiccup. That sounds like a glitch. If you've done a search before on Google, sometimes it'll say, if you do a search that's very focused, and so you only get like you know, 75 results, the kind of thing where you would page through and look at all of them, where you really could see all of them. Often, you know, it'll show there's 75 results, and so there's eight, you know, pages with 10 results each. And then you get to about page five, and then it runs out. So I think it's just, I think they call it a WAG sometimes, the number that you're going to really get, and that total number is never particularly, you know, specific unless it's a very, very small number. Even like I said, I've had ones where the results where it said there were 75 pages that were on a very specific subject and you really only got about 35. And that included when you clicked the thing that would handle duplicates.
So it's a glitch in there.
It could be kind of a glitch. I mean, the thing to realize about Google and about search right now is that search is an ever-changing, ever-shifting kind of beast, and that how they're doing it today is not going to be how they're doing it in another couple of days. And yeah, you just could have seen a peak. There's all kinds of explanations
so,
for that.
So but also, it's a lot of complex math,
mm-hmm.
and it's trying to correlate search all the way through the entire internet. And so it's kind of using algorithms like trying to pinpoint the beginning of the universe and time stretches at some point, and so it goes to infinity, and so trying to find a number in there can be...
Yeah, I wouldn't publish any blogs near the event horizon.
Like I said on the Big Lebowski, you know, there's a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous.
All right, dude. Thanks. Goodbye.
All right, good luck.
Good night.
Bye.
Well, it's good. I like, you know, hearing a happy story like that.
Mm-hmm.
$7.99 mouse fixes all.
I've never heard of a mouse speeding up a computer, but that's an awesome
His
story.
His dog came back.
Dog, yeah. Wife came back.
Wife came back.
Dog came back to life. You got happy.
The truck fixed itself.
We love those stories. Do we have some more Groovehouse?
Oh, yeah. We got room for plenty more. So give us a call, 713-526-5738. We'll take your computer calls and try and help.
Who's up next?
Up next on the show, we are going to speak with Chris.
Hey, Chris, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how are y'all doing?
We're good. What can we do for you?
Excellent. Actually, I was going to speak about one thing, but in relation to what your previous caller just said, having hardware affect browsing speed, and I wouldn't have believed it unless I saw it with my own eyes, but I'm a network technician that installs satellite internet, so I see it day in and day out, and I've actually seen a setting I can't remember specifically because it was shown to me by somebody else, but it may have been in the resolution of the screen. This was, of course, when there were multiple monitors running. I think there was two or three. And it might have been going through a USB 2.0 VGA adapter. But interestingly enough, it affected only the speed of the Internet Explorer browser. You could run other applications on that exact same monitor that took up processor space, you know, that took the machine working, and it wouldn't slow it down, but it had a direct effect on how quickly that browser loaded pages. And he could literally go in there and turn that one switch or adjust that. I want to say it was a resolution setting, I'm not sure, but it had a direct impact on the browsing speed, and it was pretty amazing. To see that could affect it in such a way, and just specifically browsing, because, you know, of course we tried opening other applications and those windows would pop open just fine. But, anyways, I hope that gives a little bit of insight. Or do y'all have anything as far as, you know, why that would occur?
It's probably because IE is intrinsically hooked into the operating system, and there's no way to separate them.
Well, the other thing is, did you ever try a different browser?
You know, I think he tried different browsers. I'm not 100% on that, but it was pretty interesting to see that happen firsthand, where he literally, I want to say, changed resolutions or a DPI setting or something to that effect. And it wouldn't affect any other application on that monitor. You could have it set on what would be the poor setting, and all the other applications would run fine. But the browser itself, you know, would just take forever to load. And from a layperson, you'd sit there and go, "Oh, my internet's giving horrible connection," or I'm not getting good connection on my network. And that just wasn't the case. It was something in the setting of the monitor. And I wish I had better information to share with you on that, but...
I don't actually know what would cause that other than if somehow the rendering size IE wasn't handling it well for some reason.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. It had to do some kind of weird conversion, or it's just, yeah. Like, it wasn't native rendering like the other applications, just all the background stuff would be. But you'd think that IE would have a lot of native engines in there, yeah. So who knows.
Anyways, I thought that was just kind of, you know, help y'all not think the other guy's crazy, but...
We didn't think he was crazy for that reason.
No, I think that's completely...
He's crazy for other reasons. Down, so. But,
so did you have a question as well that we could answer, that we've got a chance of answering, aside from saying, that's strange?
No. I was calling to tell you about wireless technologies earlier. You know, there's a lot of folks nowadays that aren't in tune with the fact that satellite internet is actually out there now. And y'all were talking about satellites and throwing cell phones into space, but it's amazing how far that technology's come now. And didn't know if y'all knew anything about it or had any questions about it.
Most of the satellite internet, I mean, as far as I know, the weak link, though, is still the upstream, right? Because do you still need some kind of connection to be able to pass or be able to request the data that's going to come down from the satellite, or has that changed, too? Is there, like, an
uplink?
Yeah, is there an uplink via satellite?
So interesting that you say that, because I just read an article in Yahoo the other day where they were still talking about telephone uplink. And talking about speeds of one down and 256K up.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality of it now is the uplink's happening from the VSAT terminal at the client's house. And it's literally being shot back out on a 1-watt radio. And we're talking about speeds of up to 15 megs down and 2 megs up.
Oh, wow. Okay. So, yeah, we've been misinformed. Because when I still think of that, I still think of really slow service. Yeah,
is that through a tower, or is it actually through the satellite?
No, we're actually talking about going back up in a satellite.
Satellite phone in your house.
There's still some issues with the latency and the VoIP systems. You know, there has been a degree of success with them, but you know the latency and the lag still causes somewhat of a delay that can be problematic in real time gaming and VoIP, but. They do even have systems out there that I don't know how they overcome that latency, but the VoIP actually works fairly well.
Well, I mean, if you're left with no other option other than dial-up, or, you know, you're looking at, you know, 15 megs down, even just a little bit up, that's worlds better than, you know, not having anything, so.
Oh, yeah. 15 megs down and up to 2 megs up, I mean... It's come a real long way.
Yeah, that's better than some wire connections in some houses. So if you've got any listeners that are out there in the weeds or in the sticks, maybe they should, you know, look into revisiting satellite.
Although it's pretty expensive still, isn't it, comparatively?
Interestingly enough, it is on the higher end, but the price point's comparable. And the interesting thing, I've been in this industry a little over 4 years now, is the base price, unlike most providers, the base price here has always remained the same, and the only thing they've done is consistently improve the speed and the amount of data they give you. So their price stability is phenomenal, and their price point, their entry price point, somewhere around $49, $59. So, I mean, it's really reasonably priced, and this service is really quite spectacular for what it does, you know. So, I just wanted to give y'all a heads up because I know y'all are rather informed people, and you see, y'all thought we were still doing telephone uplink.
That's one of the things. I mean, I don't think any of us have satellite internet just because we live in, you know, cities and stuff.
We live in the cities.
Uninformed,
right? We're stupid urbanites.
So life in the sticks is not quite as bad as we once believed.
That's
so
right.
Good news. Well, hey, thanks for the call.
Thanks for the call.
No problem, y'all.
All right, 713-526-5738 if you want to talk to us about technology. It'll answer your computer questions as best we can.
One call in the queue, lots of open lines.
713-526-5738.
I'm afraid from the description this call's going to be an exam.
I'm ready.
Yeah, I know the basics, but some of those complex like additions where they start – adding them together, I start losing it.
Raid 5, carry the 2.
You're like, oh, you know, it's raid 10, raid 1 plus 0, raid 50 RAID, yeah, 60 RAID, this, 61.
We had some RAID, some perk cards, which are the Dell hardware RAID cards, fail, where you couldn't even get into the control mechanism.
Oh, wow.
We bought some stuff. We were supposed to ship with RAID 0, mm-hmm. showed up with RAID 1. So we had to break the sets and, you know, put them back together, and they just didn't come back. So
like you couldn't see the discs on the card?
Yeah, they wouldn't come back, and not even that. We Control-R, which usually gets you into the RAID mm-hmm. configuration screen, it wouldn't even do that. So they dispatched a tech, and the awesome thing was, I wish I had been there. They dispatched the tech. The tech shows up and says, hey, I've got some video cards to install. We're like, no. So yeah,
maybe he's calling about insecticide. Well,
To like replace the cards?
No, so check it out. So yeah, they did replace the first series of cards, and then they wouldn't pick up again. We could get into the control function, but I looked, and these aren't really specialized. They're PCI cards. So I actually moved it down one PCI slot, and they all work. They work. So yeah.
Magic.
Yeah.
Did you swap out your mouse?
No, although I'm saving that. So when users start to complain about the PCs being really slow, I'm just going to get them all new mice. We're going to go. I think we're missing out on this. We need to sell some mouse oil, you know, like speed up your mouse. We can sell it under Jay Lee's name. Or we're not supposed to sell stuff or talk about prices. I guess we can't.
That's right.
Oh, well.
I think if your users complain about the speed of their PCs, that there's one that you could get that's in a brand new in the box.
I'll buy you a brand new PC.
You think it'll be faster? I'll get you a brand new PC. We'll put a side by side.
Mostly new. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Who's up next?
Up next on the show, we are going to speak with James.
Hey, James. You're on with Technology Bites.
Hey, what's going on, y'all?
Not a lot. Doing a computer show.
Entertaining show tonight.
Thanks. What can we do for you?
Well, you know, you're talking about the RAIDs, and I've got a two Dell box. It's in a RAID 5, and it has it boots from a separate disk. And the motherboard is bad, and I want to change out, loosen my data, and put it into another Dell. It's in a RAID 1, and one box is running. The bad box is running XP, and the good box is running 7. And I'm not sure, you know, I'm kind of leery on just trying to, you know, I don't want to break the RAID and not get it back like you're talking about. I'm not sure exactly how it approaches.
So are you moving it between two physical workstations?
That is correct.
And
are
two
the disks internal?
That is correct.
I would just move it over the network, maybe.
Yeah, I would consider copying the data over Ethernet. Well,
yeah, but the thing about it is that the one box with the motherboard problem, you know, it'd work for about 4 or 5 minutes, and then I'll get the blue screen, you know?
Oh.
What is there a RAID controller card in the workstations, or is the RAID, is it software RAID, or is it built into the main board? Yeah.
It's RAID into the motherboard itself.
That's the danger of having main board and motherboard-based RAID controllers, because...
You need that same RAID controller to make sure you can get the data.
Which kind of means you almost need the same motherboard.
Yeah.
Now that's the I haven't really looked at, you know, to see if both motherboards are the same, but I know, you know, they've got a definitely different internal ID. If I just try to.
You can check. I mean, the thing you'd want to check is go into the specs of the motherboard, see what controller it is. If it's the exact same RAID controller chipset, you might have, you know, a little bit of luck. Surely I would think that by plugging them in to another controller, I don't think it would damage them. Maybe it just couldn't read them. But the issue you've got is that since you're going from RAID 5 into RAID 1, if you're going from 1 to 5, it'd be so much easier. 0 to 5, it'd be so much easier. The fact that you're going from 5... to, you know, a mirrored set, because you've got, like, block-level striping, I guess, with distributed parity. You've got a very complicated RAID.
Do you know how many disks are in your RAID 5?
There are a total of 3. Like I said, I boot from one disk and then have 2.
There's got to be at least three for RAID 5.
Yeah, 3. One disk, you know, one hard drive I boot from, and then the other two are paired, and that's where I'll keep all my data.
You're going to want to try and match the controller. Oh, no, what?
No, I'm just...
Oh, just shaking your head.
No, 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 but he's saying he boots from one and RAID 5's on the others.
No.
RAID 5 has to be...
You may think you're booting from one, but technically for RAID 5 to exist, the way that it works is there are two
disks.
Volumes and a control volume, so you've got 3 disks minimum.
Exactly. I have three disks minimum. So what are you telling me? That?
So I guess you're booting from the same drive. You're not booting from one drive into a RAID.
RAID 5 is striped across, and then there's not a parity disk. Parity is striped across also. So all three disks have both data and parity. And it's designed so that you can lose one disk, and that disk the data that was on it can be derived from the parity on the other two. So without, you have to have at least three disks for RAID 5. So if you have three disks in your system, all three, and it is RAID 5, then all three disks are RAID 5, and what you're booting off of is actually volume on the RAID 5.
Okay, so I'm booting from the bottom on the RAID 5, but when I go to that physical disk, in the directory, it doesn't show me the data that I've been saving. I'd specifically save the data and have a path to save the data to, I think it's called the E drive, and it saves it there. So I'm swapped across three disks, but I'm actually booting from the RAID 5 disk.
Unless you've got a fourth disk.
Because the Savio RAID swapped out, and that's why.
When you're able to get in there, does it just show you one single drive under Windows, or does it show you multiple partitions?
It shows me multiple partitions, not multiple partitions. It shows me multiple drives.
Multiple drives?
I'm only seeing technically two drives. You know, I have a C drive, and then I have 60, and I have an E drive.
Is the E drive removable, or is the E drive a hard drive?
It's a hard drive. And that's what I'm saying is RAID 5. I have two drives in RAID 5.
Did you partition your RAID disk by any chance? Like once you created the RAID, did you make the partition to give yourself two different drives? Or are you really seeing two different volumes, like a normal drive?
I guess you could maybe equally partition all three drives and then create two RAID 5.
Only if the controller card supported it, and I doubt. I mean, maybe with software RAID you could do that. I don't know.
So what I need is a separate controller. It's almost sounding like I need a separate controller card to put in the RAID 1 box to try to boot from one of these drives. You know, I just want my data.
Here's what I would do. I mean, if check the main boards, see if they're the same RAID controller, swap them out, and then get the data off onto an external drive or however you want to do it. But the main thing is you want to be able to boot the RAID 5 into something that can recognize the data to where you can get it off.
Right.
Worst case, you could always, go onto eBay or go onto, Craigslist or someplace and try and find the exact same model of mainboard that's used or old and just plug that in long enough to get it off.
That's the thing is, in order to get that data off, you're going to either have to be able to transfer it from this system or you're going to have a RAID controller that can actually mount and see the RAID as it currently exists on those drives. And RAID tends to be pretty finicky about model versions.
Even if you've got the same manufacturer,
you have a different model, it won't work. Like you can't just hot swap or hot swap, but cold swap. You can't swap drives, from one chassis to another with a different, for example, Promise RAID system, and it won't work.
So even if they're the same, I got the same model boxes.
If it's the same model, it should work. But I'm saying if the Promise RAID versions, they're both Promise, but it's different versions of the Promise RAID chipset that they're not always transferable, even the same manufacturer. But if it's the same model of RAID chipset, then they
should. But the BIOS has to be the same too. I mean, just try that. I'd try check the second box first. If that doesn't work, then start hunting around for a matching mainboard and go with that. And if that doesn't work, I would even say check out the firmware on the mainboard and make sure that they're both matching firmwares, and then that should get it for you.
Yeah, I mean, if the two systems are the same, you can always pull the drives out that are currently in the second box that's working. Put the other hard drives in, and when you boot it up, go into the RAID. Set up instead of as a RAID 1, set it up as a RAID 5, RAID and then 5. See if you can see it.
Make sure you don't reinitialize the drives.
Don't reinitialize the drives.
Yeah, you want to try and tell, because what's going to happen is chances are the configuration data is saved in the controller. This is why I hate RAID sometimes, because they're all a little bit different. Hopefully, I mean, usually the configuration data is not saved on the drives because you can't put it on there because the RAID controller has to know how to handle the drives and how to configure them, so it's saved in the controller card. So if the controller thinks it's going to pull up a RAID 0 and there's a RAID 5, it could have some issues. So you're going to have to muck around in the RAID controller software a little bit to try and get it to work.
Okay.
But yeah, if you initialize the drives, then basically it's you're telling it to format the drives.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah, right. You don't want to do that.
You want to have it pick it up. So just good luck with that, man.
but most of the RAID systems I've worked with, when you're setting up, it'll ask you if you want to initialize the drives.
Mm-hmm.
And well, in your case, you don't want to.
Well, these are both Dell boxes.
Well, is it? So they're both Dell. Is it PERC?
Yeah.
When it pulls up, does it say PERC?
Well, let me see what it does.
Well, here's the deal. If they're both, and we probably let you go here in a few, but if they're both Dell boxes, you've got a fairly good chance of them pulling up. What you want to do is when it, right after it does the post, you're going to have like five or six lines, and it'll say like, it should say, like Dell PERC. And, you know, PRC, it's, but I don't know what it stands for, primary, some kind of RAID controller card. Anyway, look for that. If the versions are the same, I think they're up like around 5.1. If those two versions match, you've got a pretty good chance of doing it. But I would definitely go and maybe see if you can find a Dell PERC tutorial before you start to mess around with that stuff so you don't fall into a pitfall of, you know, initializing something when you don't. Because once you break that set, it's over. Like once those drives have been formatted in any kind of way, it's over. So just be very careful.
Okay, so I'm going to look at a Dell PERC tutorial.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely go into both boxes and see what into the BIOS and see.
Yeah, reboot it. If it's a hardware controller, you should see just for a few seconds some kind of splash screen of that. Generally on Dells, you're going to hit Control R to get into the RAID setup, and then you can see the versions.
Yeah.
And then if they're the same version on both boxes, you could have some.
Usually when it's booting, at some point it'll tell you something, RAID controller, whatever, and then it'll say hit Command R or something to get into the RAID setup.
Uh-oh. Right. PERC stands for Power Edge RAID Controllers. This just could be what I'm seeing in Power Edge servers, or they could have, you know, made it down to the desktop, which I think is what they're doing, because I saw PERC on, you know, the ones that came up with us. They were on workstations. They weren't on servers. So.
Yeah, this is a workstation. This is actually, there's both 690 machines.
Okay, so yeah, if it's like one of the enterprise class or business class workstations that probably has a PERC, so you're probably in good shape. So
cool.
Good luck with
all
that.
Right,
hey, worst case, you know, get the newest service tag and call Dell and just see if they can't help you. Just, you know, say, hey, this is what I did. Can you guys help me out? Maybe they can. Maybe they know some magic.
Yeah. Hey, I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, James.
Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye.
Tough problem.
But at least it wasn't a RAID 5 plus 1 or
RAID
something.
RAID 5. So, people, if you get home and you buy this hard drive system and you say, like, hey, I've heard of RAIDs, they're really, really cool, and you see all these exotic numbers, it's not like guess the number 1 through 10. Like, you want to either speed up your machine or you want to have data redundancy. Like, if it's your first RAID, don't guess the number between 0 and 1 is your first choice.
You should just write a, you, zero you should write or a one. Book.
Yeah, you write a RAID book
or
pamphlet.
Your first RAID.
My first RAID.
I'll feed it and love it and walk it every day.
713-526.
2 months later, you're not even checking to see if a drive's failed. You don't know if your hot spare is available or not.
I had to flush my RAID down the toilet. It's dead.
Sorry, I walked all over the number.
The number. And what number did you walk over?
The number for the station.
Which is?
0.
He doesn't know it.
1-1.
I don't either. I have to look
it's
at
526
it.
526 KPFT.
There you go. 713-526-5738.
Yeah.
We've got about 20 more minutes of usable showtime left. So we can take a couple calls. We got one call in the queue, so a couple more people could get in.
Yep.
All right. That about does it. Groovehouse.
Yes.
We have someone in the queue?
Yes, we do.
Who do we have?
All right, up next on the show, we're going to speak with Jim.
Jim, you're on with Technology Bytes.
Hi. I had a question. I'm wondering if there's some way I can make myself a Linux workstation with something like Mac Mini. What it is I may want to have a portable workstation that I can put in a suitcase and go, but I need a big monitor, so having it in pieces is not going to be a drawback.
Have you used Linux before? Is this going to be your first Linux machine?
No, but I've used the Unix, used Solaris.
Okay.
But, and so having it dedicated, you know, looking at the Google leads, you know, it looks like, yes, you can do it on your, you know, PowerBook or whatever. But then, you know, it's far from perfect, and it just might be easier to have it dedicated. And then, you know, the two wouldn't foul each other up.
I don't know. I don't know about Linux on some of the newer Apple hardware, if all the drivers are available.
I don't think they've got Thunderbolt figured out yet. And so if you're using Thunderbolt for the display, it may not be there. The new Mac Minis, they're not PPC anymore. They're IBM chips, right?
Yeah, they're x86.
They're all Intel.
Okay, yeah. Intel. Okay. Yeah, they're distribution. So the fact that it's an Intel chip, you can run a whole bunch of stuff out there. The main thing you're going to give up is just going to be maybe some compatibility.
You should be able to do USB. Yeah. No problem.
USB, although on the new Mac Minis, be aware there is no built-in optical drive. You have to do an external optical drive.
For whatever reason, Magic Trackpad via Bluetooth doesn't seem to be working. It's an odd esoteric thing not to do. But yeah, so you've got some choices. I would say on the Mac Mini, before you commit to anything, pretty much any distribution you'd like to check out should have a bootable CD that you can use. So that way, you know, if you've got the ability to burn a CD, you download the ISO, you burn it out, you know, as an image to the CD, and then you can boot. And most of these will try and automatically detect all the hardware, so you can get a pretty good idea of how a particular Linux distribution is going to behave before you spend the time to actually, you know, install it onto the hard drive.
Okay, well, and it doesn't have to be a Mac Mini. It's just that's attractive because that would be, you know, something like that would be a small
out of curiosity. So if you haven't gotten it yet, if you got a Mac Mini, why wouldn't you run? Does it need to be a Unix workstation? I guess you wouldn't use OS X.
Yeah, no, it's you know, specialty geoscience software that.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So you know that's it. It just, you know, if it's something small like that, so I can put all the pieces in a suitcase and assemble them when I get there, then you know that'll be fine because. I would be carting along a big monitor anyway.
Yeah, I mean, as far as power goes and price points, I think that there might be like some small systems that you could build, you know, like an IBM kind of clone solution off of. But that's going to be a lot of time and a lot of, you know, expense. You know, maybe a little bit more expensive. Yeah, Mac Mini might suit the bill for you. It really just comes down to the power that you need. Like, is the GIS stuff pretty beefy as far as what the requirements are?
It could be because there's some graphics. It's not that computationally intensive, but there is some graphics.
Well, that's the other thing too. I would find out just to make sure. Find out the distributions that program will run on, just in case it's got any kind of weird requirements. Like maybe it needs a certain window manager, or it needs a certain, you know, underlying library, it needs a certain version of something. And then let that kind of drive your direction. The nice thing is a Google search with, you know, like the model number of the Mac Mini you have and the distribution you want to try will tell you pretty quickly if people are having success getting it on there.
Okay.
So you can kind of limit it down. So, for instance, if you find out that, hey, I've heard that it'll only run under, you know, Debian, this version, and you find out that, hey, you can get Debian on the Mac Mini, but let's say you couldn't, you might want to say, like, okay, maybe I need to go look for a small form factor, you know, like ATX computer out there.
Okay.
But yeah. You don't know of any contenders, do you, really small, you know, non-Apple?
No, PCs that just like came to mind because I'm an Apple person.
All right. Asking.
Well, although if you're an Apple person and you're using a different operating system, it kind of doesn't matter.
There's
really
a lot of, I mean, but I don't, maybe they're not really popular anymore, but for a while there was a whole lot of like stuff like shoebox systems.
Yeah, yeah, really tiny systems.
Yeah, in fact, if you might swing by Fry's or Micro Center, you can still find those. They have them on the shelf and they're just bare bones. They come with a processor and a motherboard and a case and a power supply, and you add your own memory and hard drive. And those systems are very inexpensive.
Yeah, even sometimes they're marketed into like set-top boxes or media center boxes or, you know, pizza boxes is what the slang form is. But you can get some real small things, and it might even be cheaper than a Mac Mini.
Yeah, or the other option is a used Mac Mini. Some of the older ones do have the optical drive in them if you prefer that.
Okay, and then I just connect together 17 or 18 Apple proprietary connectors to get it to hook to a screen. So, all right, that would it gives me something to think about.
You got some options, so
yeah.
With HDMI, you could hook it up to the TV in a hotel room.
It would be out of the U.S., so, you know, who knows?
Who knows what you're looking to, right?
PAL and NTSC and stuff, I, you know. And plus, I would want to use the monitor at 90 degrees pivoted just because of the nature of the stuff I'm working on.
Go search, there's linuxdevices.com, and actually it looks like it's now linux4devices.com, but this used to be kind of a clearinghouse of like single chip computers, really small Linux machines back before you could get a hold of things like Raspberry Pi and Arduinos. So it looks like they're still running. They've got a lot of new stuff up there, but if there are small computers that you can run Linux on, they're probably going to list it. So go check them out. It's just linux4devices.
Okay. Yeah, I see that on a search.
Yeah, you might have to kind of scroll through to get to some of them. I'm looking at some of them. Yeah, here's an embedded PC from, wow, this is pretty nice. 4 gigs of DDR3 RAM, 2.13 gigahertz. And it looks like it's just a few inches by a few inches. Dual core Atom processor. So you got some options. There's some pretty cool small form factors out there that are just, you know, a couple $100 versus, you know, a lot more for a Mac Mini. So you got some choices.
Well, and it would be dedicated just for that.
Yeah, and it would be dedicated just for that. Like, I'm seeing, like, a Linux tablet thing that actually it's just go look. Yeah, there's some cool stuff out there.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
All right. Well, that fixes the amp for now.
All right, Jim.
Okay.
Thanks. Good night. All right. Maybe we should have strung out Jim a little bit longer because we got no calls and about 10 more minutes of airtime.
Well, you know,
we could have talked him into a complicated raid to bring with him.
Oh, we could have done like, yeah, a hypercube made out of Raspberry Pis. Beowulf cluster.
Beowulf cluster.
Jim, call back.
PlayStation 3.
713-526-5738 is the number. Give us a call. We could take your call, I suspect. We've got some time. We got all the time.
But we don't need pity calls.
We don't need pity calls. Although Barrett will be happy to talk to you about his Beowulf cluster with Raspberry Pis.
That I am building now.
So I saw another inexpensive computer that was, it's called the BeagleBone.
Oh, yeah, that's been out for, I've got a couple. And the board, yeah. We brought those out to Geek Gatherings, Dwight.
Oh, you had the BeagleBone?
If you had stopped hitting up the snacks and Clover and Sue were
doing. Oh, no. If they have
there's
cheese.
There's a newer, cheaper one that just came out a little while ago. Yeah, so it's the black one, I think it's called, the Bone Black, the BeagleBone Black. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like...
It's cheaper.
Like $25 or something?
Might be a little bit more than that.
45?
Yeah, somewhere in there. But yeah, it does some neat stuff. It's an ARM Cortex. It used to be an M3 processor. But honestly, with the video and with the stuff that you want to do, it's kind of hard to beat Raspberry Pi. Even though it's a slower processor, but as far as peripherals and ease of use...
Yeah, the things I've seen you do with the Raspberry Pi is pretty damn
impressive. That's the big thing. It's like... unless you want to go write all the code from the ground up yourself, it's better to get a hold of something that... There's like an ecosystem of software out there, and there definitely is one for the Raspberry Pi. We've got some calls, and given our short amount of time in the show, we'd probably better take some.
Yes.
We're going to go ahead and get one for Groove. Looks like Albert, you're on the show.
Hey, guys. How y'all doing?
Good. How are you tonight?
Good. Well, I'm just putting my wife's computer all back together after Windows update on the 10th. I guess they had an erroneous update, and they sent out this morning the... A repair for that update.
Oh, were you one of the affected machines? I heard about that last Tuesday, I think. Or was
it a
while ago?
The thing, yeah.
Yeah.
And had I just procrastinated like I usually do, I would be fine. But, you know,
the one time you go and you do the maintenance when you're supposed
to. So I haven't heard about this. What exactly was the problem?
Well, after the update, security update, you restart your computer, you get a check disk error.
It was... some DRM stuff, like with the UEFI stuff, and it was actually seeing some legitimately installed drives as being, hey, you shouldn't be there, I believe, in some
yeah,
stuff.
And so every time you restarted, it would run this series of tests, and which is, I guess, is an indication of possible drive failure. But if you're smart like you guys, obviously you could just check the log and see what's critical versus the warning
stuff. But anyway, they replaced the drive, and turned out it wasn't a drive. And anyway, it's fixed now. But I didn't know if anybody else is experiencing that the update this morning would fix it.
Well, that's good to know. They actually were telling people, like, hey, that update we put out there, uninstall it before you reboot. Like, bring it back in. They put out that pretty early Tuesday morning. Yeah people are blue screening, and then you can't recover from restarts.
Hmm. Yeah, and what is the Raspberry? Y'all talked about it a couple weeks ago, and you brought it up a couple more
times. So the Raspberry Pi is think about like a, you know, how you got a main board inside your computer. You know, that big thing. So take that, shrink it down to, like, playing card size.
So you know that lady that called in about that computer she was going to sell? It's basically one of those the size of a hockey puck.
Yeah. Okay. So anything you could do with a computer about 5 years ago, you can now do for a small handful of change in a very small form factor.
So it's even better than the one that she had.
Yeah, because you don't have to, you know, plug around a huge monitor. So they've got HDMI, so you can plug it directly into a TV that's HDMI enabled. It's got two USB ports, so you can do, you know, mouse and keyboard. It's got Ethernet built in, so you can, you know, plug it up to the network. And then the way that it communicates, instead of a hard drive, you have a micro SD card. So you can put an operating system on there, you put it in, it'll boot within a few seconds, and you're up and going. So people are like, what I'm using mine at home for is Xbox Media Center. Mm-hmm. And it's my, like, I can watch movies, I can watch Netflix, Hulu, I can do whatever I want to on it. So people are doing all kinds of stuff on there. But if you Google for Raspberry Pi, you will see all kinds of stuff. And even they're carrying them locally now, too. So you can either get them online, or you can, like, you know, waltz into Micro Center and pick one up.
Interesting. Okay, I will look into that. Well, listen,
they're a lot of fun.
I enjoy the show, and y'all keep up the good work.
Cool. Thanks, Albert.
Thanks.
Bye. Good night. Groovehouse.
Yes.
Speed round territory.
Yeah, close to
kinda.
It.
Kinda.
Yeah, let's take Omar.
Hey, Omar.
Hi, guys. I had a question. I'm kind of getting older. My eyes are not as strong as they used to be. I'm trying to find a cell phone that I can change the font so I can see the number or messages much easier. Do you have any recommendations for me?
I know the new Androids will, and I would assume that Apple has an accessibility setting to where it'll blow the fonts up.
Yep.
You may even be able to do it. Do you have a mobile phone right now or a smartphone right now?
Yes, I have an Android My Touch, but I haven't been able to increase the font. I mean, I barely see it now. I have to have my glasses on to be able to see my messages or by some of my phone numbers on it.
Do you know what version of Android that is? Is it like an older version maybe?
Yeah, I bought it about 2-3 years ago.
Yeah, that's probably, I think the new versions, like if you were to upgrade to a newer Android phone, anything with like the 4.0, so I think you still may be on Gingerbread is what it's looking like. You're going to have accessibility options to where you can change the fonts, you can make things bigger. There's even a mode where you can magnify things on the screen by moving your thumb around, where if you just want to view certain parts of the screen larger at one point, you can.
I see. So, but Apple has that, iPhone 4, does it have it, or is it the
iPhone
4
has,
iPhone
they have accessibility capabilities on it that will let you do a variety of things to make it easier to use and see.
I see. Okay. All right, guys. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Good night.
Groovehouse is displaying for you.
My phone will make the text by using this volume button.
Oh, that's awesome. I can actually read, like, from 8 feet away, I can read Groovehouse's text.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty neat. Accessibility. All right, and possibly our final call for the evening, we're going to take Jim.
Hey, Jim, you're on with Technology Bytes.
Hello again. I was driving through Houston and called into radio instead to call back. No, I have a question. I've got sounds like an older Mac, like iMac, like you were talking about at the beginning of the show, and I want to put more memory in it. It just has 2 gigabytes. Can you recommend a place, or should you recommend you know, one of the better ones for memory on older machines?
I've used
MacSales.
MacSales.com.
They use MacSales. I usually have bought from Crucial.
Right. Crucial or MacSales?
Crucial has MacSales probably does too, but there's a memory configurator that if you go in and put your, pick your iMac and the year, and not the model number, but just the year, like if it's mid-2007 or whatever, and it'll tell you, like, how many slots it has, what the maximum memory allowed in it is.
Are you looking for someone to install it, too? Are you comfortable doing that?
I've done it before, but not on this one. It's one of the white plastic.
Is it, Peter, what's the good site? That there, the number of sites, like one of them was like iMac Guide or iMac Breakdown, that'll tell you screen
by screen how to do it. Mac Sales has videos for most of them. They, when you configure the memory, whether you buy it from them or not, when you go to their site and you tell them which iMac you have, then they have links to videos to changing out the memory.
But the iMacs aren't too bad on changing out memory, right? There's actually an accessibility.
Right? Usually there's a little door on the bottom of it.
Yeah, although he said he's got the older one with the white plastic, so that
you might have to take the back off on that if it's, I don't know. The site will tell you how to do it. Right. It'll show you the breakdown.
And the videos are nice. They're what I use to replace the hard drive in my iMac. They're very good.
Okay, well that's I thought I'd heard something ages ago at one of the hog meetings, and that sounds like what it was because they were mentioning the how-to videos. So. That sounds like the ticket.
Nice. Well, good luck with the upgrade.
Okay. Well, thanks, and y'all have a good evening.
All right. Good night, Jim.
They also have those on their – they have a YouTube channel, and so all of those are also on their YouTube channel. You can go and pick them up there if you prefer, which also makes them embeddable. So if you're writing about it, I like to embed those in my blog when I write about that.
All right. Well, we didn't blow up the show.
Yes, we successfully have gotten through. Are we down to the... I haven't heard any music, though.
Yeah, about a minute.
Oh, okay. Well, that's about enough time to say that Jay should be back next week, right? And so we'll have the usual crew. And coming up next after this is Michio Kaku's show. Does anybody else got anything to say, or should we just introduce ourselves out?
A week from Friday, a geek gathering.
Not this Friday.
A week from Friday, at con.
Which Friday is that?
That would be a week from Friday.
Which is the first Friday.
First Friday in May. First Friday of the month is always a geek gathering.
As long as it falls on a Friday.
Exactly.
But don't try to correlate it with the first Saturday because you might not get it right.
That's right.
And if it's a leap year, then...
then we're all going to die.
Just check the website. Or just text Slicked. Say, hey, are you there?
Yeah, you might get more confused.
All right, OMW.
All right, well, I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Dwight.
And he's...
Groovehouse. Guess we're done.
We're done.
I haven't even started the music yet, though.
We're just going to end it early. Play the music till we go out.
Saeed ended early. We can end early.
Are you sure? Yeah. Is that?
Well, we don't have anyone to pick up the slack that's live. We just have recordings, huh?
Yeah.
Just blame Michio Kaku like it's live.
If Jay were here, this wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, but this is more fun.
You guys want to get out of here 10 seconds early, don't you?
Oh, you in the ring, worst way.
I was driving through Houston listening for radio shows that were badly produced.
And I found one!
Every week from 8 to 10 on Wednesdays.
8-ish to 10-ish.
Yeah, around that. Give or take.
All right, good night, y'all.
Quality radio.
Tax season is behind us, and now is not too early to start thinking about your refund as well as deductions for 2013. KPFT is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Your financial support helps the independent media you appreciate
and gets you something great in the process. KPFT is seeking your pre-pledge now. By visiting kpft.org and giving this hour, you can shave hours off the May pledge drive. You can become a sustaining member or even donate a vehicle in support of the music, news, performances, and ideas you know our city needs. Making May's fund drive shorter is as easy as visiting kpft.org. Your secure pledge online in April pays dividends today and all year round. This is KPFT Houston, online at kpft.org. Thanks for your support. The days are getting warmer, and pretty soon May will be here, bringing with it mosquitoes and plenty of heat. KPFT is stung all the time by electricity bills, equipment, many other bills, but unlike other radio stations, we don't air commercials. We ask you to support the programming you love. In May, the airwaves will be buzzing with Pledge Drive, but you can soothe the pain now by visiting kpft.org. At kpft.org, you can't swat away bugs, but you can help shoo off hours and even days from the membership campaign. You can contribute monthly and sustain KPFT for years to come. You can even donate a vehicle to help out the great music, news, and talk you appreciate. Don't forget, go to kpft.org now to support Houston's only hive of commercial-free sounds. Your support really does help. Thanks for tuning in to KPFT Houston, online at kpft.org.